This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen in for Terry Gross. When President Clinton goes in front of the grand jury on Monday via closed-circuit television, he'll be asked if he had sex with former White House intern Monica Lewinsky. He denied such a relationship last year when testifying in the Paula Jones sexual harassment case. And earlier this year, he made his now famous remark that he never had sexual relations with that woman, Monica Lewinsky. But Lewinsky supposedly has given testimony to the grand jury saying that she had sex with the president. The grand jury will have to decide who is lying, who is telling the truth, and whether a crime has been committed. My guest Jeffrey Rosen says that sorting all that out is no simple task. Rosen is legal affairs editor for The New Republic, an associate professor at George Washington University Law School, and a staff writer at The New Yorker. His article in the August 10th edition of The New Yorker is called The Perjury Trap. We began our conversation with the legal definition of perjury.
Perjury has to be both intentional and material. Those are the two prongs that have to be met. So what does that mean? Intentional means the lie has to be knowing. I have to believe that the statement was false when I made it. So in the Clinton case, if he believed that he was telling the truth when he said that he didn't have sexual relations, it would not count as an intentional falsehood. The second requirement is more complicated. The statement has to be material. This means that it has to be important enough to have some impact on the legal proceeding at the time that it was made. Now, the relationship between materiality and admissibility is interesting. In the Paula Jones case, people say the fact that the evidence about Monica Lewinsky was later ruled inadmissible means that the statement was immaterial. But that, I think, is not quite right. The notion is that if the statement was important enough to have had any conceivable influence on the proceedings of the trial, it might indeed be material.
If you're talking about an intentional lie, is it a matter then of getting inside that person's head to see whether they knowingly perjured themselves in court?
There is a bit of mind reading involved. Of course, the belief has to be reasonable. If I insist that my shirt is red when in fact it's blue, and I insist that I believe that it's red, that wouldn't escape from the knowing requirement. But there is a degree to which it's important what the person believed when he or she made the statement, and this is part of our effort to ensure that accidental misstatements, slips of the tongue, are not punished as perjury. Perjury is something we reserve for the most serious lies. This is, in English common law history, the kind of misdeed that was punished by eternal damnation. And this is why, traditionally, courts were reluctant to put defendants under oath in the first place, because it was seen almost as a form of moral torture to place someone in the awful position of choosing between self-incrimination on the one hand and eternal damnation on the other. That's a pretty serious choice, and traditionally courts have not wanted to impose it on people.
How do the courts deal with a person who lies in response to an inappropriate question?
Traditionally, courts have tried to make an account for human frailty. And the expression of this accommodation is a wonderful doctrine called the exculpatory no doctrine. What's an exculpatory no? The idea is that if you're guilty of something and a federal investigator shows up on your doorstep and asks if you did it, and you say no, and do nothing more than that, don't mislead them in any other way, should that be punished as a crime? Formally, in the post-Watergate era, some prosecutors have tried to say that that is a crime under an old law called the False Statements Act. Read broadly, this law criminalizes any misstatement to a federal official, whether or not it's under oath and whether or not it's very serious. Some lower courts were uncomfortable with this notion. They said that no one really believes these self-protective lies, so they tried to create this exception called the exculpatory no doctrine. And if the lie was merely self-protective and didn't mislead anyone in any other way, the idea was that shouldn't be punished. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court, just last January, abolished the exculpatory no doctrine. They said it might be unfair to punish people for these self-protective lies, but the language of the False Statements Act makes no exception. And in a separate opinion, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg worried that unscrupulous prosecutors, unable to prove the substantive crime they were trying to prove, would surprise people, ask them whether they were guilty, catch them in a lie, and then prosecute them for the lie rather than for the underlying crime.
Is perjury treated differently whether it's in a criminal proceeding or a civil proceeding or before a grand jury or even before Congress?
It's not. Perjury is perjury. Perjury is an intentional and material misstatement under oath. So there would be no legal difference between the president's alleged misstatements in the Paula Jones case and any alleged misstatements that he were to make to a grand jury. As a matter of prosecutorial discretion, however, we tend to treat lies to grand juries with a special seriousness. Unlike a civil deposition, you're not surprised by a grand jury. You can't say that a lie to a grand jury should be excused under a notion like exculpatory no. This is the gravest and most serious of our investigative mechanisms. You're summoned before these fellow citizens and put on your oath. You have every opportunity to reflect on the truth of your statements. So for this reason, prosecutors might choose to prosecute alleged perjury before grand juries more readily than they would alleged misstatements in civil cases.
How many people are in prison serving time or have served time because they lied in court and got caught in a lie?
I certainly don't have the figures at hand, but it is striking to me that of the convictions that independent counsels gained for alleged perjury and also for alleged misstatements under the False Statements Act, many were reversed by juries. Think of the Iran-Contra investigation. Lawrence Walsh invoked the False Statements Act to charge Oliver North with misstatements to Congress. These are unsworn misstatements, so it's not perjury. It's a violation of the False Statements Act. And he brings an indictment, and the jury considers the matter. And what does the jury do? They refuse to convict Oliver North of lying to Congress. They convict him of misrepresenting expenses and for spending too much money on a security fence, but they won't convict him of the lie. I talked to Mr. Walsh a few weeks ago for the New Yorker article, and he acknowledged that juries might have a sense that some lies are worse than others. If you're lying to protect to cover up a murder, that's one thing, but if you're just protecting yourself, then that might be more forgivable. So for this reason, when we think, it's hard, when we think of great perjury trials in the 20th century, most involve lies to Congress. Alger Hiss, H.R. Haldeman, all of the Watergate prosecutions, these are false statements to Congress. They're not, this suggests that there are not a lot of really famous perjury cases based on misstatements to grand juries and misstatements in civil cases, partly because there's a tradition, isn't there, of not prosecuting defendants for perjury after they've taken the stand to deny their guilt and are later found guilty. In theory, if we thought of any criminal case, we might be able to follow it with a perjury charge. O.J. Mm-hmm. Simpson gets on the stand, or he doesn't actually take the stand in the civil case. He makes statements about his innocence, is later found liable by a civil jury. A prosecutor might come in and say, well, didn't you lie in your depositions? You should be guilty of perjury. But because of this accommodation to human frailty and notion that, you know, let God take care of the perjury, the legal system is just going to be concerned with a substantive crime, we don't see a whole lot of perjury prosecutions. Another reason that this extraordinary Lewinsky investigation is so unusual.
Jeffrey Rosen is our guest. He's legal affairs editor for The New Republic and a staff writer at The New Yorker. He has an article in the August 10th edition of The New Yorker called The Perjury Trap, and we are talking about what the law says about lying. You write in this New Yorker article about the fact that independent counsels have, in a sense, expanded lying laws far beyond their historical roots, and I'm quoting you there, that they have criminalized the lying process. How was the Independent Counsel Act written, which gave then independent counsels this ability to expand their jurisdiction?
What the Independent Counsel Law did is create an office with one thing that ordinary prosecutors don't have. It was lacking this one crucial element, and that was political accountability. Formally, independent counsels don't have more powers than ordinary prosecutors. They have a lot more money. They have an unlimited budget. They're not constrained by the resources of an ordinary U.S. attorney's office. But the main constraint that they lack is political accountability. If an ordinary prosecutor invokes a law and stretches it in a way that it's never been stretched before, in a way that offends the sensibility of ordinary people, then there'll be political prices to pay. Either the U.S. attorneys in many states are elected, or else the U.S. attorneys in federal districts are supervised by elected officials like the Attorney General and ultimately the President of the United States. Special counsels face no such political constraints, and as a result, eager to justify their existence, here they are, they've been appointed to this important task, they've spent all this money, maybe they've spent $20 or $30 million so far and have proved unable to prove the crimes they were appointed to investigate. What do they do to prove that they're worth their salt? Well, they go and indict people for lying, often for lying to them, because if the investigation itself is so intrusive that the suspect is trying not to cooperate, it's not hard to catch people in a lie. When we add to this the notion that lies about sex are especially understandable, people have a natural impulse to lie about sex, in an age in which lies about sex are natural and all misstatements to federal officials are felonies, the combination of these two premises means that investigations that stray into the area of sexual behavior become a self-fueling mechanism for propelling perjury and false statement indictments.
But in considering the president's alleged behavior, what do you say to the argument that this is the chief law enforcement officer of the country, that the president, because of who he is and the position that he holds, really must uphold the law and must be an example, either a legal example or a moral example to the rest of the country and the world, and that lying by a president is somehow a much more serious act than lying by someone caught with their hand in the till?
This can't be right. The impulse to lie is human. Humans are fallible. The president, unlike most of us, is investigated much more seriously. Most of us don't have special prosecutors tailing us at every stage, asking our Secret Service agents to spy on us and try to catch us in a lie no matter what. Now, I'm not excusing the behavior in any way, but as a legal matter, when you think about the Rube Goldberg set of attenuated connections that led to this event, questions about consensual sex that were later found inadmissible, that arguably should never have been asked in the first place, no civilized society should ask people to describe their consensual sexual affairs in unrelated legal proceedings. So the question that shouldn't have been asked, a self-protective lie that most of us can imagine, arguably not even perjury because it might not have been material. I think there's just something profoundly disproportionate about bringing all of the brutal machinery of the legal system to bear on catching someone out in a situation that I think many of us could imagine ourselves acting similarly.
And that's Jeffrey Rosen, our guest today on Fresh Air. He's legal affairs editor for The New Republic. He's also a staff writer at The New Yorker. And in the August 10th edition of The New Yorker, he has an article called The Perjury Trap. We're talking about lying and the law. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Jeffrey Rosen today. He's legal affairs editor for The New Republic, a staff writer at The New Yorker, and we're talking about lying and the law. That's the subject of his August 10th article in The New Yorker called The Perjury Trap. We've been talking about perjury and the many layers of perjury, but I wonder if we're talking about, when we talk about subordination of perjury, whether we're getting into a much more complex part of the law having to do with obstruction of justice and conspiracy and cover-ups.
Those are very scary words, aren't they, when you use them?
Sure.
Like that, obstruction and subordination. In the post-Watergate era, obstruction of justice, too, was expanded so that often misstatements to a federal official that might have had to do with other people increasingly came to be punished as obstruction. So this notion of seriousness, of grave misleading, was abandoned, and the idea is that any kind of misleading could count as obstruction.
But is that how witnesses got away with saying things like, I can't remember, I don't recall, that it may not be a direct lie about something, but it may not be the whole truth?
A very sensible legal strategy, isn't it? You know that we teach in criminal procedure classes, if you're ever accused of anything or if you're the subject of an investigation, even if you're innocent, it's a very good idea to keep your mouth shut, just to remain silent. Pleading the Fifth is something that the president can't do politically, but it's something that ordinary citizens are well advised to do because your words can be turned against you and prosecutors and policemen can tie you in knots and can trap you in all sorts of ways. I don't remember and I don't recall is a very very sensible response for someone who's the target of an investigation.
In talking about the president's case, the alleged lie took place during a civil trial, which got thrown out of court. This, of course, was the Paula Jones sexual harassment case against the president. How have courts typically dealt with this kind of scenario?
Well, few courts have been asked the precise question that the Lewinsky investigation poses us with, just because few prosecutors would prosecute alleged lies and dismiss civil cases, because most of them have better things to do. But this is not to say that the fact that the case was thrown out means that the lie is legally insignificant. The question is whether the lie was important enough to have influenced the Paula Jones case at the time that it was told. So the fact that first the Lewinsky evidence was ruled inadmissible and then the entire case was thrown out doesn't mean that the lie was immaterial. It just suggests that this is not the kind of case that ordinary prosecutors would actually prosecute.
And does the law define sex?
Interestingly, in the Paula Jones case, it does. There was an extraordinary document that the Paula Jones lawyers presented the president with. They said, Mr. President, I'm going to show you a definition of sexual relations. I want you to read it. And then Jones's lawyer, James Fisher, pushed across the table a written document which, in scatological detail, said, for the purposes of this deposition, sexual relations shall be defined as, and proceeded to enumerate just a gruesomely specific series of, contact between various private parts of one person's body with that of another person's body. And then it concluded, for purposes of sexual gratification.
Hmm.
So this is why I talked to one of Jones's lawyers a few weeks ago, and almost half jokingly he said, well, maybe the president could try to wiggle out of his alleged misstatement by arguing, I hated every minute of it. It wasn't for purposes of gratification, even assuming that I had this contact.
Under the law, could he say that, in a sense, be honest?
The question is whether he believed that the statement was false when he made it. That's the requirement, that a law has to be intentional in order to count as perjury. So he could. Alas, for his sake, that was the first prong of this three-pronged scatological definition. The second two parts of the definition seem to close the trap by saying that almost any contact between one person's intimate parts of the body and another were defined as sexual relations for the purposes of the deposition, which is why a source close to the president's legal team suggested to me recently that, well, maybe the president's best response is to say, I didn't remember the definition. It was so complicated that I didn't knowingly lie because I couldn't take it all on board.
I figure you're not in the advice business, but do you have advice for the president when he gives his videotape testimony before a grand jury about what he should and shouldn't say, how he should and shouldn't present his side of the story?
Of course, I'm not in the advice business. I feel sheepish presuming to speculate, but there seem to be some basic rules. One is that an ordinary suspect would be well advised to plead the Fifth. Even if you were innocent, it would just be a very good thing not to make things more difficult and to set himself up in a perjury trap in which his statements to the grand jury could be contrasted with his statements to Jones's lawyers. But assuming that that sensible legal avenue is closed to him, it would seem a very good idea to tell the truth. At this point, further lies, or lies to a grand jury, would be far more serious, largely because there's likely to be far less wiggle room. Jones's lawyers, according to my source, were embarrassed talking about sex. They didn't have it in them to say, did you touch her here? Did she touch you there? Mr. Starr, for all of his vaunted delicacy, is likely to be far less circumspect, and the questions that will be posed to the president next Monday will be brutally and embarrassingly specific and will leave little wiggle room. So at this point, it's probably would be a good idea to tell the truth.
And if that truth doesn't square with the truth that was told in other proceedings, what's the punishment for that?
Well, the argument might be that there's no perjury, that the misstatements to the Jones lawyers he believed were true when he made them, either because they weren't material and also because in his mind what he did didn't meet the definition of sexual relations that the Jones lawyers told. And so that didn't count as perjury, and then he told the truth to a grand jury. he could plausibly argue that there's no appropriate legal remedy. Now, of course, all this is both complicated and enhanced by the fact that no court will ever review these alleged misstatements. Congress, most people believe, is the only body with the constitutional authority to review allegations against the president. And in the course of impeachment hearings, impeachment sounds like a serious word, but impeachment hearings can refer to Congress's attempt to consider far less grave punishments than impeachment. Congress has the authority to censure or to reprimand or to fine. There are all sorts of lower level shaming punishments that Congress exercised in the 19th century, and they might well, since no one seems to have an appetite to remove the president from office for these alleged misstatements, might well conclude there's really no high crime and misdemeanor at stake here because there's no perjury before the grand jury and the Jones misstatements are too ambiguous to be clearly perjury.
Jeffrey Rosen is legal affairs editor for The New Republic and staff writer for The New Yorker. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen in for Terry Gross. We've been talking about perjury and the Independent Counsel Act with Jeffrey Rosen. He's legal affairs editor at The New Republic and a staff writer at The New Yorker. His most recent article in The New Yorker is called The Perjury Trap. Rosen also teaches at George Washington University Law School. It's interesting to think about this case and to think about the fact that the country is privy to lots of information or alleged information about public officials, someone such as the President of the United States. Are you concerned that there is no privacy or no right to privacy anymore?
Very concerned indeed. And I think that one of the few useful things that's come out of this investigation is to remind or to teach ordinary Americans how little privacy we have. It's a very interesting story about how it was that the law of privacy came to be eroded for innocent people as well as guilty people. It turns out that the most serious erosions of the law of privacy took place in the 1960s and 70s at the hands of the very Supreme Court that's often accused of exalting the law of privacy too far in the abortion cases. And it's a complicated and interesting story, but it perhaps can be dramatized by the notion that in the 19th century, if a prosecutor wanted to come and subpoena your private diaries, where you recorded your most secret thoughts, that was considered a core violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures of persons, houses, papers, and effects. And if we fast forward to the late 20th century, think about a case like Bob Packwood, Senator Packwood, whose diaries were subpoenaed and challenged them, invoking these 19th century cases, and was told that the law of privacy had been pulled out from under him. This just shows us how far the law of privacy has eroded. So I think the Lewinsky investigation has reminded all of us of that.
And what is the impact of that, that erosion of privacy? Some have said, well, then certain qualified people won't run for public office because they know what their private life is about and they don't want it open for public inspection.
Well, that's certainly one danger. That's privacy violations that come at the hands of the press, which faces properly no legal constraints on its ability to write about private lives. But I think an equally troubling consequence of this is that ordinary citizens, private citizens, now realize that if they're the subject of an investigation or if their employers are interested in finding out things about them, there's very few private spaces for us to record our private thoughts free from the prying of government investigators. And this can't be a good thing in a civilized society.
I think we understand that someone who's a public person, whether they're a celebrity or a politician or a public official, that their right to privacy is somehow different from the rest of the population, that they're two different kinds of privacy. Are you seeing then the erosion of the privacy for just regular folks, that their lives are also potentially opened up for scrutiny?
Isn't that what Monica Lewinsky teaches us? Here's this young woman who committed no crime, who was a private citizen who didn't ask to be part of a lawsuit and suddenly was forced to discuss her most intimate sex life under oath in a legal proceeding against her will, who had her private bookstore purchases subpoenaed, who had her mother forced to testify against her. Monica Lewinsky, for better or worse, her legacy in American history will be ambiguous, to say the least. But the one thing she's shown us is the costs of a society that doesn't protect the privacy of ordinary citizens. And I have to feel some sympathy for her for that reason.
Elizabeth Holtzman, who was one of the authors of the original Independent Counsel Act going back to the Nixon era, had a piece in the New York Times on Monday saying that, "I never dreamed that a special prosecutor would be using his enormous powers to investigate accusations about a president's private and legal sexual conduct." I know that the Independent Counsel Act is up for renewal in a couple of months. How would you like to see it rewritten?
I would like to see a stake driven through its heart and to see it wither on the vine and absolutely
completely.
Just let's rid the country of this scourge. I'm not at all sympathetic to the halfway reform proposals because it seems that they're cosmetic changes. Even narrowing the scope of the targeted officials to the president and vice president would hardly make things better. The grave constitutional anomaly of the statute, as Justice Antonin Scalia pointed out in 1988 when he dissented from the Supreme Court's decision to uphold its constitutionality, is the peculiarity of investigating and subpoenaing a president in the ordinary course of law at the same time that many people believe that the president can't be criminally tried before he's removed from office. So this odd constitutional atavism would hardly be saved by narrowing the scope of covered officials. It seems I'm also... it seems like former Congresswoman Holtzman is a little ingenuous when she claims to be surprised by this. The Starr investigation may be the reductio ad absurdum of the flaws of the Independent Counsel Act, but for the past 20 years, we've just seen a parade of independent counsels spend a tremendous amount of money and end in rather trivial results. So I don't know about the politics of the situation, but there's a growing consensus among liberal and conservative legal scholars that the best solution would be to let the act expire entirely and allow wrongdoings of high officials to be prosecuted by the Justice Department, perhaps even in a special office with someone who is appointed for a term of years that exceeded that of a particular administration, as was the case in Watergate. Archibald Cox was not hampered by the fact that he was formally under the supervision of the Attorney General. On the contrary, he was enhanced. Think of this interesting parallel. Archibald Cox was the former Solicitor General of John F. Kennedy, who defeated Richard Nixon. Kenneth Starr is the former Solicitor General of George Bush, who was defeated by President Clinton. Who had more moral authority to investigate the president? Cox did, because he was chosen by the administration that had been of the opposite party. If Kenneth Starr had been appointed by Janet Reno, rather than by these three unelected judges whose political partisanship was suspect, he might have had far more political and moral authority than he does now. So I'm not moved by the arguments that high wrongdoing cannot be effectively prosecuted by the Justice Department itself.
So we don't need the Independent Counsel Act.
Let's get rid of it and let it die. That would be the one good thing that could come out of this this dreadful period in our politics.
Well, Jeffrey Rosen, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jeffrey Rosen is legal affairs editor for The New Republic, an associate professor at George Washington University Law School, and a staff writer at The New Yorker. His article in the August 10th edition of The New Yorker is called The Perjury Trap. This is Fresh Air.